This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to read again from, I think, what has to be my favorite book in the whole world, The Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. It was published in 1949. Leopold died in 1948. He had been turned down by quite a few publishers, so he did not see his book published. He wanted to call the book Great Possessions. I'm going to read the April chapter, which I love. The first part of the April chapter is called Come High Water. The chapter ends with Leopold's description of his family's discovery of the woodcock's sky dance. Then I will read from Fran Hammerstrom's book, Walk When the Moon is Full, the April chapter. She and her children get very close to a dancing woodcock. The male woodcock's display continues well into the night and well into June. This is a wonderful time to go out and see if you can find a woodcock displaying at dusk in the evening. Listen for them. Listen for the peep, peep. And now, Aldo Leopold, Come High Water. The same logic that causes big rivers always to flow past big cities causes cheap farms sometimes to be marooned by spring floods. Ours is a cheap farm, and sometimes when we visit it in April, we get marooned. Not intentionally, of course, but one can, to a degree, guess from weather reports when the snows up north will melt, and one can estimate how many days it takes for the flood to run the gauntlet of upriver cities. Thus, come Sunday evening, one must go back to town and work, but one can't. How sweetly the spreading waters murmur condolence for the wreckage they have inflicted on Monday morning dates. How deep and chesty the honkings of the geese as they cruise over cornfield after cornfield, each in process of becoming a lake. Every 100 yards, some new goose flails the air as he struggles to lead the echelon in its morning survey of this new and watery world. The enthusiasm of geese for high water is a subtle thing and might be overlooked by those unfamiliar with goose gossip, but the enthusiasm of carp is obvious and unmistakable. No sooner has the rising flood wetted the grass roots when here they come, rooting and wallowing with the prodigious zest of pigs turned out to pasture, flashing red tails and yellow bellies, cruising the wagon tracks and cow paths, and shaking the reeds and bushes in their haste to explore what to them is an expanding universe. Unlike the geese and the carp, the terrestrial birds and mammals accept high water with philosophical detachment. A cardinal atop a river birch whistles loudly his claim to a territory that, but for the trees, cannot be seen to exist. A rough grouse drums from the flooded woods. He must be perched on the high end of his highest drumming log. Meadow mice paddle ridgeward with the calm assurance of miniature muskrats. From the orchard bounds a deer evicted from his usual daytime bed in the willow thickets. Everywhere are rabbits calmly accepting quarters on our hill, which serves in Noah's absence for an ark. The spring flood brings us more than high adventure. It brings likewise an unpredictable miscellany of floatable objects pilfered from upriver farms. An old board stranded on our meadow has to us twice the value of the same piece new from the lumberyard. Each old board has its own individual history, always unknown, but always to some degree guessable from the kind of wood, its dimensions, its nails, screws, or paint, its finish or lack of it, its wear or decay. One can even guess from the abrasion of its edges and ends on sandbars how many floods have carried it in years past. Our lumber pile, recruited entirely from the river, is thus not only a collection of personalities, but an anthology of human strivings in upriver farms and forests. The autobiography of an old board is a kind of literature not yet taught on campuses, but any riverbank farm is a library where he who hammers or saws may read at will. Come high water, there is always an ascension of new books. There are degrees and kinds of solitude. An island in a lake has one kind, but lakes have boats, and there is always the chance that one might land to pay you a visit. A peak in the clouds has another kind, but most peaks have trails, and trails have tourists. I know of no solitude so secure as one guarded by a spring flood. Nor do the geese, who have seen more kinds and degrees of aloneness than I have. So we sit on our hill beside a new-blown pasque and watch the geese go by. I see our road dipping gently into the waters, and I conclude, with inner glee but exterior detachment, that the question of traffic in or out is, for this day at least, debatable only among carp. And the next part of the April chapter is called Draba. Within a few weeks now, Draba, the smallest flower that blows, will sprinkle every sandy place with small blooms. He who hopes for spring with upturned eye never sees so small a thing as Draba. He who despairs of spring with downcast eye steps on it unknowing. He who searches for spring with his knees in the mud finds it in abundance. Draba asks and gets but scant allowance of warmth and comfort. It subsists on the leavings of unwanted time and space. Botany books give it two or three lines, but never a plate or portrait. Sand, too poor, and sun, too weak for bigger, better blossoms, are good enough for Draba. After all, it is no spring flower, but only a postscript to a hope. Draba plucks no heartstrings. Its perfume, if there is any, is lost in the gusty winds. Its color is plain white. Its leaves wear a sensible woolly coat. Nothing eats it. It is too small. No poets sing of it. Some botanist once gave it a Latin name and then forgot it. Altogether, it is of no importance. Just a small creature that does a small job quickly and well. The next part is called Bur Oak. When school children vote on a state bird, flower, or tree, they are not making a decision. They are merely ratifying history. Thus, history made Bur Oak the characteristic tree of southern Wisconsin when the prairie grasses first gained possession of the region. Bur Oak is the only tree that can stand up to a prairie fire and live. Have you ever wondered why a thick crust of corky bark covers the whole tree, even to the smallest twigs? This cork is armor. Bur Oaks were the shock troops sent by the invading forest to storm the prairie. Fire is what they had to fight. Each April, before the new grasses had covered the prairie with unburnable greenery, fires ran at will over the land, sparing only such old oaks as had grown bark too thick to scorch. Most of these groves of scattered veterans, known to the pioneers as oak openings, consisted of bur oaks. Engineers did not discover insulation. They copied it from these old soldiers of the Prairie War. Botanists can read the story of that war for 20,000 years. The record consists partly of pollen grains embedded in peats, partly of relic plants interned in the rear of the battle and there forgotten. The record shows that the forest front at times retreated almost to Lake Superior. At times it advanced far to the south. At one period it advanced so far southward that spruce and other rearguard species grew to and beyond the southern border of Wisconsin. Spruce pollen appears at a certain level in all peat bogs of the region, but the average battle line between prairie and forest was about where it is now, and the net outcome of the battle was a draw. One reason for this was that there were allies that threw their support first to one side, then to the other. Thus, rabbits and mice mowed down the prairie herbs in summer, and in winter girdled any oak seedlings that survived the fires. Squirrels planted acorns in fall and ate them all the rest of the year. June beetles undermined the prairie sod in their grub stage, but defoliated the oaks in their adult stage. But for this geeing and hawing of allies, and hence of the victory, we should not have today that rich mosaic of prairie and forest soils which looks so decorative on a map. Jonathan Carver has left us a vivid word picture of the prairie border in pre-settlement days. On 10 October 1763, he visited Blue Mounds, a group of high hills, now wooded, near the southwestern corner of Dane County. He says, "I ascended one of the highest of these and had an extensive view of the country. For many miles nothing was to be seen but lesser mountains, which appeared at a distance like haycocks, they being free from trees. Only a few groves of hickory and stunted oaks covered some of the valleys."
Unquote.
In the 1840s, a new animal, the settler, intervened in the prairie battle. He didn't mean to. He just plowed enough fields to deprive the prairie of its immemorial ally, fire. Seedling oaks forthwith romped over the grasslands in legions, and what had been the prairie region became a region of woodlot farms. If you doubt this story, go count the rings on any set of stumps on any ridge woodlot in southwest Wisconsin. All the trees except the oldest veterans date back to the 1850s and the 1860s, and this was when fires ceased on the prairie. John Muir grew up in Marquette County during this period, when new woods overrode the old prairies and engulfed the oak openings in thickets of saplings. In his boyhood and youth, he recalls that the uniformly rich soil of the Illinois and Wisconsin prairies produced so close and tall a growth of grasses for fires that no tree could live on it. Had there been no fires, these fine prairies, so marked a feature of the country, would have been covered by the heaviest forests. As soon as the oak openings were settled and the farmers had prevented running grass fires, the grubs, the roots, grew up into trees and formed tall thickets so dense that it was difficult to walk through them, and every trace of the sunny oak openings vanished.
Unquote.
Thus, he who owns a veteran bur oak owns more than a tree. He owns an historical library and a reserved seat in the theater of evolution. To the discerning eye, his farm is labeled with the badge and symbol of the prairie war. And the next part of this chapter of April is called Sky Dance. "I owned my farm for 2 years before learning that the sky dance is to be seen over my woods every evening in April and May. Since we discovered it, my family and I have been reluctant to miss even a single performance. The show begins on the first warm evening in April at exactly 6:50 p.m. The curtain goes up 1 minute later each day until 1 June, when the time is 7:50. This sliding scale is dictated by vanity, the dancer demanding a romantic light intensity of exactly 0.05 foot candles. Do not be late and sit quietly, lest he fly away in a huff. The stage props, like the opening hour, reflect the temperamental demands of the performer. The stage must be an open amphitheater in woods or brush, and in its center there must be a mossy spot, a streak of sterile sand, a bare outcrop of rock, or a bare roadway. Why the male woodcock should be such a stickler for a bare dance floor puzzled me at first, but I now think it is a matter of legs. The woodcock's legs are short, and his struttings cannot be executed to advantage in dense grass or weeds, nor could his lady see them there. I have more woodcocks than most farmers because I have more mossy sand, too poor to support grass. Knowing the place and the hour, you seat yourself under a bush to the east of the dance floor and wait, watching against the sunset, for the woodcock's arrival. He flies in low from some neighboring thicket, alights on the bare moss, and at once begins the overture, a series of queer, throaty beats spaced about 2 seconds apart and sounding much like the summer call of the nighthawk. Suddenly the painting ceases and the bird flutters skyward in a series of wide spirals, emitting a musical twitter. Up and up he goes, the spiral steeper and smaller, the twittering louder and louder, until the performer is only a speck in the sky. Then, without warning, he tumbles like a crippled plane, giving voice in a soft liquid warble that a March bluebird might envy. At a few feet from the ground, he levels off and returns to his painting ground, usually to the exact spot where the performance began, and there resumes his painting. It is soon too dark to see the bird on the ground, but you can see his flights against the sky for an hour, which is the usual duration of the show. On moonlight nights, however, it may continue at intervals as long as the moon continues to shine. At daybreak, the whole show is repeated. In early April, the final curtain falls at 5:15 a.m. The time advances 2 minutes a day until June, when the performance closes for the year at 3:15. Why the disparity in sliding scale? Alas, I fear that even romance tires, for it takes only a fifth as much light to stop the sky dance at dawn as suffices to start it at sunset. It is fortunate, perhaps, that no matter how intently one studies the hundred little dramas of the woods and meadows, one can never learn all of the salient facts about any one of them. What I do not yet know about the sky dance is, where is the lady and just what part, if any, does she play? I often see two woodcocks on a painting ground, and the two sometimes fly together, but they never paint together. Is the second bird the hen or a rival male? Another unknown. Is the twitter vocal or is it mechanical? Another unknown. Up to what stage of nesting does the male continue the sky dance? My daughter once saw a bird painting within 20 yards of a nest containing hatched eggshells, but was this his lady's nest? Or is this secretive fellow possibly bigamist without our ever having found it out? These and many other questions remain mysteries of the deepening dusk. The drama of the sky dance is enacted nightly on hundreds of farms, the owners of which sigh for entertainment, but harbor the illusion that it is to be sought in theaters. They live on the land, but not by the land. The woodcock is a living refutation of the theory that the utility of a game bird is to serve as a target or to pose gracefully on a slice of toast. No one would rather hunt woodcock in October than I, but since learning of the sky dance, I find myself calling one or two birds enough. I must be sure that come April, there be no dearth of dancers in the sunset sky. And that's the end of the April chapter of A Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold. And now I'll read from Frances Hammerstrom's book, Walk When the Moon is Full. Remember, she was Aldo Leopold's student and such a gifted writer. This is the April chapter of Walk When the Moon is Full. Shall we go for a walk? I heard the sound of a woodcock painting its mating call. The children looked at their mother as though she were absolutely silly. It's not dark yet, they protested. I know, she answered, looking intently out of the window at the fading day. I think we'd better get started right now. Both children objected. It's too early to go. Get your raincoats, dears. Raincoats? Alan protested. It's not raining. Hush down. Now let me explain. We're going to try to sneak up on a woodcock and watch it painting on the ground. You don't have to wear the raincoats. They're just to hide under. If we don't start now, we may not find a woodcock. It's almost dark. They headed straight for the abandoned field where dark pines and white birches grew. They lifted their feet high where the grass was deep and only slightly flattened by the winter's snow. When they got to the clearing, where mosses and low sedges covered the ground, they stood still to listen for the beep, beep of a woodcock. Franz said, "Listen carefully. I'll squeeze your hands when it's time to talk." Elva's hand kept squeezing and tugging till Franz gave the signal. Elva spoke first. "I hear five or maybe six. One by the house, one by the barn, one by the machine shed, more toward the pond, and one right here." "I hear one," said Alan, "behind those two pines." "If it's any comfort to you, Alan, I wasn't sure I heard any, but I saw one go down behind those pines." "Who could hear the twittering flight song when the woodcock went up?" Franz asked. "I could," said Elva. "Elva is the youngest member of the family," said Franz, "but tonight she leads the expedition. We need her good hearing. When his painting stops and the flight song starts, we'll run almost to those pines and hide under our raincoats. When Elva says the flight song has started, we'll rush to where he painted and hide again." Brambles caught at their clothes. They scuttled when the woodcock's flight song started. But in the blackness of the night, they scurried too far. The woodcock, dark, small, and swift, swirled down out of the sky in a great sweeping arc right behind them. Peek, peek. He strutted on the ground by a big old anthill, and then, swift-winged, faster and faster in upward curves, he flew toward the starry sky again. "Let me have one of your shoes, Elva, quickly." "Why?" Franz didn't answer. Elva handed her a shoe, and Franz ran crouching toward the anthill, leaving the shoe near it. Not until she was back hiding with the children did she whisper, "Maybe he'll think it's another woodcock." And he did. He swooshed over their heads and lit near Elva's shoe. He raised his rings right over his head and dashed at it with little runs. "He touched it, Franz. He touched my shoe." Swifter than a swallow, the woodcock swooshed past them and disappeared into the black night. It was time to go home and getting colder. They were glad they were wearing rain gear for warmth. They pushed past brambles and through sweet fern toward the path. Gradually as they walked, the night got lighter, until the faint orange glow of the rising moon guided their footsteps home. And that's the end of Franz's chapter about her ventures with her children. I hope you'll get out and hear the woodcock this spring. Get outside and use your ears. That's the best way to find them. In his writing, Aldo Leopold had some questions. One of them was about whether the males breed with more than one female. And I found something on a good website that everybody who enjoys birds should know about. It's called allaboutbirds.org. Easy to remember. I'll read it to you. "Some males display at several singing grounds and mate with multiple females. The female often visits four or more singing grounds before nesting, and she may keep up these visits even while she cares for her young. The male gives no parental care and continues to display long after most females have laid eggs." And Leopold also wondered whether the twittering sound was made mechanically or vocally, and I see a beautiful drawing of the outstretched wing of the male woodcock. And the outer three primaries are so narrow that they really don't look like they would function with any kind of lift for flying. And those are the feathers that produce the twittering sound. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.